app marketers. How's the ROI of your app? At Adjust, we'll help you automate, analyze, and optimize all your marketing campaigns. In one platform, you can identify your best users, protect your campaigns from fraud, and track in-app interactions to monitor retention, LTV, and more. Request your demo at adjust.com and try our mobile analytics platform for free. Grow now.
Attention all personnel, please clear the launching area.
Fire, fire.
Oh, baby. I'll give it to you.
That was really good.
Yes, it does. It's dead on.
Okay, keep the chatter down in this room.
Are you ready to begin?
Yes, I'm all set, yeah.
Hello, welcome to Space Boffins in partnership with The Naked Scientists with Richard Hollingham and Sue Nelson.
I was about to say my own name there. And Sue Nelson, yes, yes, here I am.
Hello.
This month, four astronauts, including an in-depth and revealing interview with retired NASA astronaut Nicole Stott on her book, what she's learned from her two space flights, and what we can learn too, including the idea of make haste slowly.
All will be explained. Mm-hmm. In the last podcast, we played an interview I'd recorded a while back with Apollo astronaut Charlie Duke to celebrate the 50th anniversary of Apollo 16. And despite, well, should we say some interesting views on science,
yes.
I'm sure you'll agree he is an all-round great guy, a legendary astronaut.
Absolutely. Charlie was also one of the guests at the AIM Higher Gala that was recently held at the Science Museum in London. And the event paid tribute to the mission while also looking ahead to humanity's future on the moon with the Artemis program, commercial space travel and exploration, and how it makes life better on Earth, basically. And it was a very glamorous event. To be honest, it's much more glamorous than most of the space things or science things we go to.
Normally in some seedy back room, aren't they?
Yeah, with warm wine. And I felt really underdressed because a lot of people were in ball gowns, but I wore a dress made out of a fabric printed with the blueprints for the Apollo spacecraft and the Saturn V rocket. And that was a big hit. So I sort of felt okay there. There was even a red carpet.
You didn't wear a red carpet.
No, no. But that's where I had to be. A bit like, you know, you see Hollywood stars coming
in. Like the Oscars.
Yeah, it was. And I felt,
There weren't any Will
I Am or... No, I would say George Clooney, I think I'd like. Sorry, who were you thinking of?
I'm trying to think of the guy who slapped...
Oh, Will Smith.
Will Smith.
No, there was no slapping happened on the red carpet. But it did mean that because I had to sort of stand there with other people beside me, that it was quite a noisy environment because I was there with a microphone. So, you know, excuse the background noise, but, you know, when you're at these glamorous events, this is what happens. But I did...
Do you want to say glamorous again?
Why, what did I say?
Well, no, you could say glamorous a lot.
Oh. Well, I'm obviously just... not used to it, am I? What's another word for glamorous then? What can I say?
Smart, posh.
Posh, smart, glamorous. Yeah. You see, glamorous. Sorry, I'm sticking with it. With this glamorous event, I did manage to grab some pretty good speakers there.
My name is Charlie Duke. I was the lunar module pilot on Apollo 16, which was the fifth landing on the moon.
Now, tonight is an astronaut awards, and it's celebrating a number of different astronauts and different missions and people, including yourself. And in terms of the return to the moon now, how do you feel about going back?
I would like to go back, but they're not going to call up an 86-year-old to send them up there. I'm very excited about Artemis at the cruiser training. The equipment's being built, and we're going to land near the South Pole with Artemis and start building a moon base. And I'm very excited about that.
Are you a great supporter of more independent, privatized space flight in terms of the direction this has gone away from, well, not away, but not just the big space agencies, but bringing in private companies as well?
I think it's a great step forward, a giant leap forward, as Neil Armstrong said. I'm very excited about the commercialization with SpaceX's Blue Origin, Virgin Galactic, all of the ones that are going to take people up, and some orbit, some just up and down. But it'll change the perspective of the humanity, I think, on to see the curvature of the Earth and the blackness of space. It's life-changing, it really is. So I'm very excited about it.
And have you ever been tempted to go up with some of the independent companies like SpaceX or Blue Origin?
I would like to, but I've never been invited. So
consider this a very public invite.
Okay.
Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Fine, thank you. Well, have you got a few seconds?
I've always got a few
all
seconds.
Right. Just for ID purposes, if you would give your name and title.
Tim Peake, ESA astronaut.
Right. And what is the sort of importance of tonight's event, apart from obviously being, you know, you're in your bow tie looking like a penguin?
Well, tonight is a celebration of space. It's really important to recognise past achievements and talk about the future. And tonight is the celebration of the 50th anniversary of the Apollo 16 landing. And so it's really exciting to have Charlie Duke here and also to be able to talk about what we're going to be doing in space over the coming years.
How do you relate to somebody who went to space, you know, over 50 years ago? Do you still find you've got something in common, or is the sort of advance of technology meaningless in that way?
We've got loads in common. Surprisingly, little has changed in some areas. I mean, Charlie's from a test flying background. I was talking to him earlier this evening about, you know, the aircraft he's flown and what he's enjoyed the most, and some of the test flights he's been on, and also about the technology that they had on their mission as well, with the lunar rover and the kind of protocols they had in place for their lunar landing. A lot of those protocols haven't changed either. We've learned from the Apollo missions, and we've really brought that knowledge forward. So we're now just applying the knowledge that these pioneers were out there, you know, doing.
Now, obviously, you're taking a bit of a sabbatical at the moment, and you're writing books and going around and giving talks. Are you leaving the life of an astronaut for good, or is the door still open? Do you want to return, or are you having too much of a good time?
No, not at all. I'm leaving the door completely open. In fact, I've just got back from Germany. I was there all last week at the European Astronaut Centre interviewing candidates for the new selection process. So that was wonderful to be back at ESA. And of course, over the last 2.5 years, I haven't really been able to get back to ESA as much as I'd like because of the travel restrictions. But now that we can travel, I'm going back there more often. And so very much working closely with my ESA colleagues.
And if you could do another mission and you had your sort of choice of it, what would it be?
It would be Artemis. I don't have to think too hard about that. I mean, ISS low Earth orbit is wonderful, fantastic experience, the spacewalking, the science that we're doing. But as a test pilot, I think, you know, Artemis holds a special appeal to be able to go further into space to explore the moon. That holds a real special place in my heart.
Well, I'll keep the fingers crossed for you.
Thank you,
Sue. Sure, you don't need my luck. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Susan Kilrain. I was a space shuttle pilot for STS-83 and STS-94.
And how did you take on the mantle from Eileen Collins? Was it a good inspiration for you?
She's a great inspiration, and, you know, she kind of broke that glass ceiling, and I was able to come in without, you know, even considering that I was a woman.
And what for you would you say was the highlight of your mission?
Well, we did 16 days of science dedicated to life here on Earth. So we were trying to make this a better world, which is what this event is about, space for a better world. And our mission definitely reflected that.
My name is Poppy Northcutt, and I don't really have a title. I mean, you know, the reason I'm here is because I was the first woman in mission control in an operational support role. I worked on Apollo 8, 10, 11, 12, and 13 in terms of being in the control center. I was a return to Earth specialist. So if you wanted to go, you wanted me working on what you were doing because you did want to get back. And the software that I worked on, developing the abort program, the return to Earth program, that was used in all of the lunar missions to bring the astronauts safely back to the Earth.
And, you know, you're well known as well for that wonderful photograph, the sort of only woman's right. face in a sea of very identical looking men, just yes. purely, I think, because of the way people dressed in those
right,
days,
right,
with the
right.
shirt and ties.
Right. Well, I jokingly, they talk about these astronauts wearing their astronaut jacket. I said, well, you know, if I wore the mission control costume, it would be a pocket protector, a white shirt, a black tie, and black slacks.
I'm Amanda Lou Falkenberg, and I'm composer of the Moon Symphony.
I've actually heard part of this Moon Symphony pre-pandemic, small audience, Nicole Stott in there as well, and it was stunningly beautiful. So how has it progressed since then? Because at that point, you were trying to get a wider audience for it. Where are we now?
Yeah, so that was like the beta-tested audience back then, and that was at the time I didn't have vocals inserted with the libretto. But actually, COVID allowed me to hire 12 voices where they recorded individually in their studios in London, sent us the music, and that way I laid their voices in the symphony whilst we were waiting for the world to open up. And I'm very happy to report that in a month's time, we were going to have 60 voices singing the choir at Abbey Road Studios with the London voices, so not 12 isolated, but together with 60. And Maren Allsop is our conductor, and she's going to be leading the London Symphony Orchestra on the 20th and 21st of May for the orchestral professional recording at St. Luke's.
That's wonderful. I mean, so in a way, this is the funny thing about the pandemic, isn't it? For some people, it's just been the most awful period of their lives. And for others, it's been an awakening. And for others, it's actually been a sort of blessing in disguise.
And I think, I feel that the message and the themes of this symphony absolutely tie into what we've been exposed to as a race, a fragile race. And these are the lyrics, obviously in the culminating seventh movement, the crowning moment. And corona means crown. And so all these themes are just playing to the message, the planetary message. And so I find that very interesting to see how that is all overlapping into the symphony.
A short extract of the Moon Symphony by composer Amanda Lee Falkenberg, which I'm really looking forward to hearing in its entirety. And plus, you also heard Apollo Return to Earth specialist, the legend that is Poppy Northcutt. And fingers crossed, we're going to be getting her in a future podcast so we can talk to her in a bit more depth. You also heard former NASA shuttle astronaut Susan Kilrain, ESA astronaut Tim Peake, and Apollo astronaut Charlie Duke.
And to be clear, it was a glamorous event.
It was a glamorous. It was a very... But we even had a goodie bag. I've never had a goodie bag, I don't think.
And it was more than just like a flyer for something, wasn't it? Because often you get a goodie bag and think, oh, it's a goodie bag, and it's just like some 20% off voucher
oh, no.
or something.
Oh, no. There were quite cool things in there, like a water bottle. I know, see, I'm easily... Hollywood stars get like $75,000 for a voucher for a trip to an island. And here's me really happy with a water bottle. But it had a water bottle. It had one little gadget that you... a light that you can clip onto your phone or your laptop when you're doing a Zoom. I just thought it was, well, I'll say yes, I am.
So I had a water bottle and a torch.
Yeah, yes. Well, I loved it. And huge thanks to Jonathan Levy or Levy. I'm not sure how you pronounce his surname. But yeah, that was great. Thank you very much for getting us on. And I must tell you about one of the best moments happened early on in that evening, in that I didn't recognise a lot of the other journalists. I did. There was somebody from the British Interplanetary Society, and I said, "Oh yes, I saw him." But the others, I didn't, and they didn't know me either. And that's fine. But they had never. Quite a few of them, like from big national newspapers. We're not the science specialists or space specialists. So they were saying, do you know anything about this? And I said, yes, I do specialise in this. I said, don't worry, I'll point out who the people are and what they do. And, they were grateful, but at the same time, you did see them just thinking, who is this old bird, just sort of in this ludicrous Apollo dress, some
sort of weird dress, yes. Space groupie that's crept in
and,
behind
and, you know,
rope.
Just as that, all of a sudden you heard this voice go, Sue, how are you? And up comes this glamorous, oh, I've used that word again. It was a glamorous woman. She looked amazing in this emerald green satin or silk long dress, gave me a great big hug, said, oh, it's great to see you in it. And then when she went off, the journalist from the Daily Telegraph said, who is that? And I said, oh, that's shuttle astronaut Nicole Stott. And I saw his face look at me with like, oh, slightly. And literally just as that happened, and the other journalists were all looking at me thinking, oh, hello, another voice, this time a male voice, went, hi, Sue. And they all turned around and it was Tim Peake. And I have never felt so like seen.
You will never have that credibility again.
I will
again.
Never have that again.
No.
Ever, ever, ever. But yeah, what a moment.
This is Space Boffins. We're in partnership with The Naked Scientists. Do get in touch with any thoughts you have on social media, and we will try to be better at it. I've actually done some tweeting this week.
Oh my goodness, yes, that's very unusual. No, it wasn't like a shopping list or something, was it? You've got a mistake. Oh.
And don't forget, there is a vast archive of Space Boffins going back almost 11 years. That's to the very dawn
of time.
Podcasting. The dawn of podcasting. I feel if I could work out, I'm sure there's an echo facility on this. If we could work it out, I could have an echo there. Dawn of podcasting.
Dawn of time. I just
dawn
have this vision.
I mean, it's amazing. 11 years.
Yeah.
I mean, no one knew what a podcast was 11 years ago.
No. I feel
now everyone's got a wretched podcast.
When we were making them, monkeys were banging sticks next to a monolith.
Next to iPods.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, that was the thing. Now, as you heard from the fact that I mentioned there was this very glamorous, I'm trying to think, elegant, there you go, I can use that, elegantly dressed astronaut Nicole Stott, that she was there too, and yet she didn't feature on that little montage we had earlier with some amazing astronauts in. And there's a reason she didn't feature in that, because we wanted a more in-depth conversation with Nicole, because she's always been interested in using space to improve life on Earth, which is what that Aim Higher Gala was all about.
And what we wanted to talk to her about was this
that's
book.
Actually, what you should do is do that lovely paper thing. You know,
yeah,
well, like a pack
to.
Of cards.
I think it's hard. It's a hardback book, and I put lots of post-its in. I put post-its in, which are relevant to the questions
okay,
you're going to hear.
Go.
No, I can't do it. Hold on.
That's it.
Is it? There we go.
Oh, I like it.
Okay.
Yep.
This book. It's called Back to Earth: What Life in Space Taught Me About Our Home Planet and Our Mission to Protect It. And Nicole began by explaining why she didn't want to write a traditional astronaut memoir.
It took a little time for me to come to where I found myself with Back to Earth. And I'm so thankful that I waited, a couple years versus rushing to write the book right after retiring from NASA. Because I think there was a lot for my own, I don't know, my own maturity even in this post-NASA life of where was I at? What was I wanting to do that felt meaningful to me, that was really leveraging the experience I had and bringing that to life even more and finding even more value in that? And so very thankful for the time it took me to get to the place where the story that comes out in Back to Earth came to life.
That's sort of reflected in the fact that what you've written is very different to the usual astronaut biography, because it does have a message. I like the fact that you've got all these, you've done journalism in it, you interview colleagues, and your chapters have all got these nice titles that refer to both living on the space station and being on Earth, like act like everything is local, or one chapter is called Never Underestimate the Power of Bugs. What gave you the idea to do it and break it up into sections like that?
First of all, I want to say that in the stories that the memoir, like books that my colleagues have written, I do really appreciate them, because there are little tidbits of all of this stuff that I've captured in their books too, right? But for me, it felt like it was a lot more important to reflect on those ways. And that's what we came to, was this idea of the ways of being, the ways of living and working together as an international community on the space station that just seemed so obvious, really, to how we should be doing things down here on Earth. And that's what I think took the time for me, is how do I encapsulate, you know, chapter by chapter, these ways that allow me to showcase what does it mean to say that everything is local, and to showcase the work that's being done on the station that is representative of that, and the science that goes along with that too, because I think there's this wonder that people have about what really is happening on the space station and across the people and the partnerships that are happening up there. But then what is already happening down here on Earth? How are really extraordinary people and organizations already behaving like crewmates, doing what's necessary, living in these ways that kind of brings it all together? That's what seemed most important to me in the lessons of how we've been so peacefully successful on the International Space Station is through these, you know, seven ways of being. And there's probably more.
Well, but, I must admit, I did learn quite a lot from it. And I think that was from the fact that you did interview people, whether it was colleagues like, you know, the astronaut Serena, I have no idea how you pronounce her second name, but it's Serena Chancellor, isn't it? She's got a middle name.
Onan Chancellor, yes.
Onan, yeah, I couldn't work out how to pronounce that. And the marine scientist, for instance, Rowan Henthorne. Mm-hmm. Did you enjoy that? Because normally you're the one being interviewed.
Did you enjoy doing it? Yeah, I loved it. It was really nice being on the other side. But I also discovered, and God bless you guys, how difficult that is to interview someone and have it feel fresh. Right? Have it feel like I wasn't asking them the same questions that they get from everyone else. And that is really difficult to do. And then to capture who they are, the significance of their message, and why I'd even want to include them in the book. Because there's a lot of people out there like that, right? That I could have included. But these were people that somehow along the way, somewhere I had made some even peripheral connection to, that really struck me as important to include.
You have a line actually in that chapter that Sue mentioned, never underestimate the importance of bugs. You have a sentence, there's always more to each of us than you can see on the surface. And I just wondered, was it helpful being an astronaut, talking to other astronauts, to kind of break beneath that surface? Because I often find, particularly with NASA astronauts, that it's difficult to break through that kind of buttoned up on message NASA attitude and actually reach the real, understand the real person, the real motivations, feelings, emotions, all those sorts of things.
Yeah, I think that that's probably true in any, you know, in any line of work where your colleagues, especially where it's a small community, the NASA astronaut community. Right now there's what, 40 active astronauts? And I don't know what the total is over time, but if they're alive, you pretty much know them if you're one of them, right? and then the same is true for our international colleagues. It's a relatively small community. And at some point along the way, whether it's at a reunion or through training, you're going to have met each other, encountered each other. And I think that just takes that guard down a little bit. But I think we all are respectful of each other too. And I mean, that's the way I feel with you guys, right? I do tend to let myself open up a little bit more with you guys because I trust the encounters we've had before, the beautiful work that you've put together as a result of our conversations. And I, you know, I'd hope you agree, the friendship that we have now is a result of that. And
absolutely.
And that, I mean, that's the way I feel about my astronaut colleagues. And it does, it makes it easier to just get down in there and perhaps not have to ask the higher level questions and just go for the meat of it. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, on that, I mean, you know, you obviously talk a lot about the cooperation in space, the And we, you know, we've heard this a lot from astronauts, this idea of no borders. Can it be different, though, in space when you've got, for example, Russia invading Ukraine on the ground? How do you square the two?
Well, I think that it's a really difficult question, isn't it? And I think if we look over the history of cooperation in space, it hasn't, because I'm alive and experiencing it as in your face, really, as what's going on right now, right? I mean, I have friends, people I consider to be family in Russia that I'm really concerned about them and how this is affecting them. And yet I'm like, what the heck is Russia doing? How in the world was this the choice to make this day and age, right? But in the space environment, somehow, you know, even during Cold War, pre-Cold War, you think about the Apollo-Soyuz timeframe, that wasn't all that happy-go-lucky down here on Earth between those countries either. And somehow we had that handshake that really led forward to so many amazing things internationally in space. And I say in space, but I mean between the people down here on Earth as well. And I have been really trying hard to imagine what the conversations are like on the space station right now, floating around the dinner table, looking out the window. And all of those people, I'm sure, are reflecting and, you know, holding each other close and, you know, in a way that we probably can't really imagine or understand down here on Earth. And like we always did, they're probably trying really hard amongst the six or seven of them to solve the world's problems, you know, to come up with the solutions and figure out a way that they might be able to communicate those to the, you know, the folks in charge back down here on Earth.
Yeah, it's interesting. ESA astronaut Matthias Maurer, you know, has recently returned from the International Space Station, and that was something that, you know, was brought up with him, and they agreed. You know, he was talking about how challenging the whole situation was for them, and I think it really also reflects that, you know, you get astronauts always talk about, you know, when you look down on Earth, you can't see borders. And one of your chapters is The Thin Blue Line, is about that atmosphere being the only border that matters.
You know, I get goosebumps thinking about it, just closing my eyes and remembering that view from that, really extraordinary vantage point of, wow, we live on a planet. I mean, we all know that, right? It seems so simple. It's like, yes, yeah, Nicole, wow, we had, you know, a miraculous revelation that you had, you know, in space, but it's huge. I mean, the planet's huge too and small at the same time. But that thought, that reality is so powerful, I think. And it's why I love the idea of comparing the ways we live and work on a space station, this mechanical life support system in space, to our planet. And this total equality in my mind of a thin metal hull of a space station to the thin blue line of our atmosphere, that I think people, and I do the same thing. I'm looking out my window right now, and honestly, the blue looks like it goes on forever. And I think I say it in the book, it's like, oh yeah, we're out there. It just seems like it's just there doing what it's supposed to do for us and without us having to have any regard. In fact, it's like this veil thin layer, you know, wrapping around all of us. And it really and truly is, when it comes to borders, the only one that matters. It is the only one that is protecting us from that deadly vacuum of space that ultimately could be our collective demise.
And you use that as well to then go into some of the VOCs, the volatile organic compounds, and what we actually put into our atmosphere. Mm-hmm. So again, there's this environmental theme throughout.
Yeah, and it was interesting. I wasn't really in the beginning after coming up with the just the concept, the structure of, okay, we're going to look at it from, you know, these ways of being and how we live and work in this place and how that parallels what we should be doing down here on Spaceship Earth. Climate change and the environment weren't necessarily what I would have focused on its own, right? Because to me, the way we live and work there and the how we behave like crewmates, it's a way for us to solve any of our most challenging problems. But my publisher was, and I very thoughtful about this, my editor, and she's the one who suggested, hey, let's use climate change and the environment as the example throughout the book and be able to really point to that in a meaningful way. Because then, you know, in conclusion, you can show how it relates to solving any challenging problem. And I'm really thankful for that because it's something I'm very passionate about to begin with. And I hope that shows in the book. And, you know, there's a point in the book where I talk about whether you believe in the words climate change or global warming, you can look at what's happening around you. A lot of that information coming to us from our space-based assets and know that we're having an impact on our life support system. And that's the key to me, is people just acknowledging the impact that they have individually and collectively on our ability to survive here. And hopefully that's where the call to action comes from as well.
No, I think that's right in the book. And it's not, you know, because if you just go on about the environment all the time, you know, as someone, I used to present an environment program on World Service, people get bored. I was cancelled.
It can be counterproductive.
Yeah, I think the way, you know, it's absolutely very well done in the book. Can I talk about the scary stuff, though? So you've got this, go slow to go fast is what your chapter's called. But actually, there's a great paragraph, no freaking out. This is all about, you know, kind of what you do in an emergency, what we can learn from that. Well, I mean, before we get into that, can you just talk about the launch on the shuttle? Because I remember when, I think this might have been when I first interviewed you, and I interviewed Mike Massimino around a similar time. Just how terrifying launching into space is.
I love the way Mike says it because he's like, doesn't he say something about how you're on the van driving out to the launch pad and you're thinking, man, they're not going to let me off the bus now. You know, even if I wanted to, they're not letting me off the bus now. I don't know if terrifying is the word. And maybe there's a level of naivety with respect to what terror should be. But there's certainly respect, right, for what you're about to do. There's an understanding of what it means to, I think, be sitting on the top of this machine that's going to have 7 million pounds of exploding rocket thrust underneath you. You know, I mean, that's a big deal. It's dangerous. But I think we do all this training, right, for all of the things that we think we know can go wrong and how humanly possible to deal with it, that there's a comfort level there and a trust in the team that's working with you on it. The terror to me, and I feel like I can use that word. I always used to just say the fear or if I was afraid or scared was really for my family watching me do it. And, you know, thinking about my 7-year-old son and my husband and my mom and my sisters watching me strap onto this rocket and witnessing the power that it takes to get out of Earth's gravity hold on us and into space. That was a bit terrifying and fearful for me, just the thought of what they were going through. But the ride is amazing and it is explosive and it is dynamic and you are shaking like you never imagined your body could shake before and feel like three of you are sitting on top of you. And in that first minute and a half off the launch pad, after those solid rocket boosters light, and that's when you really know you're going to space, right? Yeah, and I'm just rambling on this because it's so exciting. I get like,
I know, it's great. We're with you.
I'm there.
I'm shaking.
But it's so because you go from this really peaceful, just relaxing. You know, you've gotten all cushy in your seat and you're comfortable, and You're out there a couple hours before launch, so you have time to get comfortable in your seat and relax a little bit. And the crew doesn't really get involved, at least on the space shuttle missions. We didn't get involved till about actively until about 20 minutes before launch. And so, I mean, I remember napping for a little while, and looking around at my crewmates doing the same, just really kind of finding that, you know, namaste zone to be in and being really comfortable. But then you go from just that peaceful, quiet comfort to the 10-9-8 thing, which is where you finally believe you might actually launch to space, because you don't believe it until I think that's happening. And then at 6 seconds on the space shuttle, that's when the fuel started flowing from that big orange tank down to the three engines on the back of the orbiter. And I always thought that would be really rough, but it wasn't. It was just like this smooth kind of rumble, and you could hear it a little bit, but it wasn't very shaky at that point. And the interesting thing about that was, though, is that the engines on the back of the orbiter are at an angle. So when they start spewing out their exhaust, the whole tip of the space shuttle stack, the whole thing all together on the launch pad, would tip forward about 10 feet, and then it would rotate back, and perfectly timed at zero was when the solid rocket booster, the big white, you know, rockets on the side of the shuttle would light. And that's when it all like cut loose. You know, it got really loud. You really started shaking. You knew you were moving super fast. Like, was I ever on a launch pad kind of fast? And you're in your mind, I remember at least thinking, man, I hope we're going in the right direction. Because, you know, because there's not, in that first minute and a half, there's not a whole lot the crew can do other than monitor the gauges, talk to the ground. And, you know, on the one hand, it's like, oh my gosh, there's nothing the crew can do in that first minute and a half if, you know, something went wrong. But also it's like, and I don't know if they purposely did this or not, but it's like, man, it's kind of good to let your body, you know, your mind respond to all of that energy that was happening around you, all that load on your body, and, you know, high five your crewmate next to you, big smile coming across your face, a little, you know, woohoo under your breath, because you don't want to like yell that out loudly and be unprofessional or anything, but to just as a human acknowledge what's happening to you. And then 8.5 minutes later, you're orbiting the planet. You've gone from zero to 17,500 miles an hour. And if you unstrap, you're going to float. And it's just incredible. And that, I mean, that's the other, like the question of terror or fear was like getting to space and realizing that you'd made it there safely. It's like, wow, okay, I'm here. I'm really here and I'm alive. I made it here alive, and now I can float up and look out the window and get to work and really enjoy it.
That's how I wondered when you're going around the Earth at 17,500 miles per hour, you can actually have a chapter called Go Slow to Go Fast when you are traveling that fast. You know, how do you mean that? Obviously, this is, you know, links into what Richard brought up about the priorities as well when you're in space, that include no freaking out.
Yeah, I think I think I mentioned in the book too that we pretty freely steal some of the SEAL mottos, the Navy SEAL mottos, in the astronaut office. And I think that's because there's a lot of military folks in the office who bring those with them.
Yeah, I've got one here actually. I haven't got the page open. It's slow is smooth, smooth is fast.
Sounds Orwellian, doesn't it?
Doesn't it? Yeah. And then for the life of me, I can't remember what the emperor or the, what was
Make haste slowly.
Yes, make haste slowly. I thought that was so cool. And I mean, that's what the SEALs based their, slow to go fast thing on, and what we do as well. And it's like, everything has an appropriate pace for it, right? And I think we've all had situations in our lives where if we could go back and do it differently, we wouldn't have freaked out as much about something or turned the drama on or gotten so wound up that we lost sight of what the problem even was. And I think that's what it's getting at, is everything doesn't have to be fast. It just has to be done at the appropriate, you know, at its right time and the appropriate speed, and you know, to allow us to digest what's going on, but respond to it effectively, efficiently as well. And when we talk about emergencies, you know, on a space station, the three that we classify as emergencies are fire. You know, you don't want a fire inside of your, you know, contained space. It's you can't just open the window and, you know, let it air out or just jump in your spaceship and escape anytime. And, you know, same thing with like a toxic atmosphere. We have really highly concentrated ammonia that's used in some of our systems. And, you know, you don't even want to smell that because then you know it's too late. And, you know, getting a hole in your spaceship where all the air starts spewing out, like a depressurization. Those are the three biggies. And in any of those situations, it's incredible to see how it almost feels like slow motion, the way we respond. You know, you take in the signals of what's going on. You look at the information. You deal in a very, what we call, you know, the, I always forget it. Oh my gosh, the checklist. Boldface, the boldface checklist. I can't even remember the name of the checklist, let alone I could probably not even remember the checklist themselves anymore. But the things that you've trained so much that you just know, okay, I have to immediately do these in response to this alarm that's going off. And that's, I mean, that's the kind of thing that happens around, you know, our house too, if things are going right, or with our children. And, you know, there are things, you know, you just need to immediately do to safe the situation, and then to really, you know, then you have the time afterwards to just psych it out and figure out what really was happening and keep it from happening again. And in all of that, you don't do yourself any favors if you're freaking out. It just doesn't help. And I've been witness to how the opposite just works so beautifully. And it allows you to take care of all of your crewmates to make sure that, you know, no one's left behind, and to hopefully put yourself in a position where you're not having to deal with that same problem again.
You said you've been witness to that. So did something happen during one of your missions?
Well, I think every mission, yeah, I think every mission has its alarms and bells and whistles going off throughout it. And during my first flight, which was the long duration flight on space station, yeah, I mean, every week or so, some alarm would be going off. Normally, it was in the middle of the night, you know, God forbid that happened at noon where everybody's just up and around and ready to deal with it. It would usually happen at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, you know, some big klaxon alarm going off telling you that it's got indications that air is leaving the station or that there might be smoke or fire or something. And it was just really, really impressive to me to see how everyone would float out of their crew compartment, their little sleep station in the middle of the night. The lights would come on. We'd make sure we had accounted for all of us. And we were six on the station, you know, all six of us get to that place on the station that we were always trained to go to respond to any emergency situation, make sure everybody was okay, and deal with it, communicating with the ground if we could. And like you should hear, I think, treating everything like it's real until you discover that it's a false alarm.
That's good. And,
you know, thankfully, most of the time it was a false alarm up there. You know, something was going on that caused the alarm to go off, but it wasn't significant in a way that caused us to be under threat ourselves, or that something catastrophic could have happened to the station. You know, very thankful for that.
Finally, I wanted to say how much you stress the importance of mentors, and you pay quite a tribute to quite a few women that you've met, and some of them, you know, you interview, and that you included. I thought this was so thoughtful, a link back to earthbook.com to get in additional information on the people that you'd mentioned. I thought that was a brilliant idea. But is there any of the people, I know you shouldn't have a favorite, but I bet you do, who would you say has been the most important mentor in your life?
Oh my gosh. And especially when I think of women, I mean, there's no denying my mom for sure. And I think that a lot of times people think that's the easy answer, to give. It's not an easy answer, but it's the answer for me, for sure. And it's the obvious, and I'm so thankful. I mean, I know I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you right now if I didn't have a mom who was willing to perhaps set some of her fears aside to let me really grow and figure out where I could do the most good in the world. And I, as a parent, I know that's a difficult thing to do.
Also, she must have been, I was quite, I hadn't realized that your father had died shortly before your 16th birthday. And that that closeness with your mum and that strength must, at a very important time in your life as well, when you're sort of deciding what do I do and where do I go, that's when you see people at their worst and their best.
Yes. And I think I was really fortunate to witness my mom as a parent, as, you know, as a guardian, you know, all of that that goes into parenthood, I guess, you know, at her best. I think about it, I don't know, three young girls, you know, your husband dies, and then one of them wants to go off and pursue something pretty immediately that is associated in some way with how that happened to him, you know, flying, aviation. I can't imagine being able to support that. But her example, you know, by allowing that with me, supporting that with me, is what gives me hope that I can do that same thing with my son, you know, if when that challenge comes my way too.
Astronaut Nicole Stott. Her book is called Back to Earth. And this is a very Radio 2 type link here. Let me do this again. Her book is called Back to Earth, and we have a book coming out. It's from the team behind our other space podcast.
So ignore what all those rave things we were saying about her book.
Her book. Like, you can buy two. You can buy more than one book.
This is all about
us. Buy her book. Pre-order.
And we were being genuine about it. It is great.
It is really good. No. Honestly, it's really good. Anyway, our book.
Uh-huh. Another nice sound effect there.
Yep. It's from the team behind our other space podcast, the Supermassive podcast, which we make for the Royal Astronomical Society. It is called The Year in Space Annual from the Supermassive podcast.
But because it's the team behind it that have written it, both of us are writers in this, along with the presenters, Becky Smethurst and Izzy Clark. And
Robert Massey from the Royal Astronomical Society. It's really good.
And Sarah Wild.
Sarah Wild. It's really good list of authors. It's published in October. You can pre-order it now from Amazon at a discounted price. It's quite a substantial discount. Now, I'm not sure whether having a discount on Amazon means it's a good thing or it means that no one has pre-ordered
well,
it.
Well, I never knew this with the Wally book. And you have to be really careful that you don't get obsessed about it, because otherwise... And I thought it was just me. And then because I follow different authors on Twitter, you realize, no, it's everyone. If whoever has a book out, they can't help it. And they keep saying, oh, I've gone up four places, you know, or I've gone up 100, number 432.
Yeah, 16,222.
Well, that's the thing, how quickly it can go. Literally, a couple of people will buy your book and you'll go from 15,000 to four. Yeah, so it's all smoke and mirrors, but yeah.
Anyway, you can pre-order it. I've seen the early spreads for it, and it looks gorgeous. It is going to be in all bookshops from October, but it looks lovely.
And I've really enjoyed researching for one of the specific articles I've written about. So I think people will get new information and stuff in a really readable, quirky, fun way.
Well, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's the Space Boffins podcast.
We could have been
describing us, really, couldn't we? Quirky,
fun, glamorous. Well, that's clearly not true.
Yeah.
Anyway, listen to some of our other podcasts. They're great.
I'm depressed now. I'm not glamorous. Yeah, we'll be back next month and I will make an effort with my clothes. But the great thing about doing a podcast is that no one can see the fact that I'm in a pair of shorts and shoes that probably I should have worn socks with. And us being in a little confined studio space It's not a good idea on a warm day, is it, Rich? Sorry about that. Thanks for listening.
Hey, app marketers, how's the ROI of your app? At Adjust, we'll help you automate, analyze, and optimize all your marketing campaigns. In one platform, you can identify your best users, protect your campaigns from fraud, and track in-app interactions to monitor retention, LTV, and more. Request your demo at adjust.com and try our mobile analytics platform for free. Grow now.